This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Brine Field Services leader, Zelandes. Check them out at Zelandes.com. That's Zelandez.com. Hi, it's Joe Lowry. Welcome to another episode of the Global Lithium Podcast. Today is episode 184. My guest is Michael Dunn, who leads Dunn Insights. He's an EV expert and also has a podcast called Driving with Dunn. You won't come across many in the EV sphere that have more experience, especially in China, than Michael Dunn. He was first in China in 1986 as a student. He moved there full-time in 1990 to start an auto consulting company, really before China even had an auto industry of any significance, and well before EVs. But he stayed the course. He was in Asia for 26 years. You'll hear all about that as he goes through his backstory and we get into a discussion about where EVs have been, where they are, and where they're going. Without further ado, Michael Dunn. Michael Dunn, welcome to the Global Lithium Podcast.
Joe, thank you so much for having me. I've been looking forward to this day.
Given this is your first appearance, as well known as you are, maybe some aren't sure about your background. Why don't you give us the backstory?
All right, so I'm a Detroit boy, born and raised in the city, one of seven kids, the fourth of seven, and the son of Jim Dunn, who was the automotive editor at Popular Mechanics for many years, and more importantly, had built a notorious reputation as a car spy. So my early life, I was the getaway car driver, as he had his long lens Nikon out the passenger car window. We were scouting places in Milford, Michigan, Kappus Casing up way up north, out to Death Valley just to get next generation Corvette or whatever was the prey of the day. So I grew up around cars in Detroit with my father. And then he also encouraged all of his kids to memorize poems. And the one that was most remarkable to me was Robert Frost's The Road Not Taken. Two roads diverge in the yellow wood. We all know that from school days. But I really took it to heart, and he encouraged me right out of school not to take a job with the Detroit 3, which all my friends were doing, but rather jump across the pond called the Pacific Ocean and try to start a business on my own in China. 1990, I land in China, and I'm there to open a market research consultancy firm to help all those Western automakers get into this delicious, magnificent market called China. Only one problem: there were no cars. It was all bicycles and no private ownership. So the beginning was a little rough, but I decided to stay and remained in Asia for the next 26 years. Yeah, so I'll pause there. We don't want to go through entire history, but you get the feeling. The starting point's usually the most relevant.
What's your business today, and how are you spending your time?
Right. So I was in Asia, lived in China, Thailand, Indonesia. And during that time, I started companies, ran companies that essentially worked with automakers, suppliers, and investors to get into Asian markets because that's where the growth was. Then when I decided to come back to the United States about 6 years ago, I saw the emergence of this powerhouse, potential powerhouse in China with EVs. And I thought, now is a good time to go home to the United States and start advising investors, automakers, suppliers here and in Europe on the coming storm. Who are these Chinese automakers? How powerful might they be? And what are the best ways we can prepare for competition on our home turf? So that's what Dunn Insights does. We advise automakers, investors, and suppliers on the future of electric vehicles with a special focus on what's coming out of Asia.
Well, you showed up in China before they had many cars. Before there was a commercial lithium ion battery, actually.
Yes.
So now we're at the cross section of EVs, battery demand, and that is what drives the lithium industry now. And since this is a lithium related podcast, it's a very timely episode with you. I just got back from Asia. Everything's positive there on the whole EV story, even with the perturbations. At a high level, what are your thoughts on where the global EV market is? And then we'll get into some of the navel gazing that seems to be happening in the United States about EVs.
Once again, the United States seems to be the exceptional country. Yeah, we love our American exceptionalism, and here we go again. So just go around the horn a little bit. In China, new car sales, EVs are about 33, 35% of new car sales in the world's largest market. So that's they're far and away the leaders. Then in Europe, it's about 15%. Here in the United States, hovering around 8, 9%, and maybe falling a little bit this year. So, as the saying goes in Silicon Valley, the future is already here, but it's just unevenly distributed. And China is 5 to 10 years ahead of the West, and the West is trying to figure out, wow, can we catch up? How do we catch up? Maybe we don't even want to try to catch up. They're so far ahead.
You had a recent article, The Sudden Death of Detroit in China. It painted a pretty bleak picture. And I lived in China probably during the salad days when
Oh, yeah.
half my neighbors were working for GM, and GM felt fat, dumb, and happy, I think, with what was going on in China. Even though, and that was, I got there in 2005 and lived there through 2010. But even by the time I was leaving, the green shoots of the Chinese EV industry and the battery business, which they had to be successful in battery before they could be successful
Yes.
in EVs, was Detroit's demise in the Middle Kingdom a self-inflicted wound, or just something that was going to happen because that's the way China does business? They bring you in, they learn technology, and then they show you the door.
That's the playbook. There's no exceptions. There's how China does it. Brings in world-class technology, leaders in respective industries, learns as quickly as they can. And then gently, no kicking us out, not like, oh, get out of here, but gradually easing us toward an exit. And this is exactly what I saw with General Motors. You know, the demise of General Motors is accelerating as we speak. In 2017, GM hit a peak of 4 million cars sold in China a year. That was the biggest market by far. They're making profits there. Today, it's half that size, Joe. And the profits have dropped by 60%. So, I don't think it's an exaggeration to project the trend and say within the next 5 years, I expect GM and Ford to essentially, they're not relevant anymore. They're not competitive. The Chinese look around and say, what do we actually need you guys for? Not just the government, but consumers too. So, it's the beginning of the end of Detroit in China. You ask, well, was it all by design? Did we have any sort of roll in it ourselves as American automakers? For sure. For sure. And the most important aspect is China announced 10 years ago, we're going electric. Hello, we're going battery electric cars. That's the future. That's what we want to do. And joint ventures across the board, including GM, Ford, Stellantis, Hyundai, Toyota, said, we think you're bluffing. We don't believe it. We'll believe it when we see it.
That's shocking because I went to the Shanghai Auto Show in 2010, and the EVs weren't really EVs. They didn't even have batteries in them. They were like concept cars. But I did a keynote at the Qinghai Green Energy Festival in 2014. They were having an EV rally around the lake, but I sat in a, this is 10 years ago, and I sat in an SUV that I thought, I think about buying this thing. And this was 10 years ago. And it was before anybody outside was seeing it, but GM had a lot of people in China. So was it just groupthink? You don't need to learn Chinese anyway, just stay in your little Shanghai bubble
Yeah.
and not pay attention?
That Shanghai bubble is intoxicating. Such comfortable living with drivers and cooks and shuttle to the office and back, and you go to the best kids go to the best schools, and it's easy to get separated from reality. But I think what happened there was that for years, Joe, you'll remember this when you're there 2005, 2010, you walk the streets, whether it's Shanghai, Beijing, Guangzhou, you name Chongqing, and global brands dominated. And people in my office, they bought a Chinese brand when they couldn't afford a global brand. Oh, Joe got a Chery. Oh, it's not making that much money. However, his wife won't let him spend more. Okay, got it. So China, I remember a meeting with the Minister of Industry at the time, Wang Gong, in 2009 in Beijing. He was at a symposium. And he said, actually, he's a straight talker. He said, actually, we're quite frustrated at this juncture. We're now the number one producer of vehicles in the world. We have the biggest market in the world. But all I see on the streets of Beijing are foreign brands like Hyundais and Buicks and Toyotas. Where are the Chinese brands? How do we change this game? How do we flip this script? So you could imagine that global automakers got accustomed to this culture of Chinese consumers forever preferring foreign brands. And then they weren't, until they weren't, until such time that that changed. And all of a sudden, whoa, whoa, wait a second. This has been the Bible for 25 years. And now their Chinese consumers are liking Chinese brands. It did come kind of abruptly, and it's understandable how they might have been taken by surprise in that regard.
You have to have a very, very interesting perspective because I first went to China in 2000, and outside of the big three cities on the East Coast, if you went to Chengdu, it was mostly bikes. When I went running in the morning, it was a sea of bikes, not a traffic jam. And 10 years earlier than that, I think the stat is in 1985, China had 20 kilometers of highway.
Right.
And I'm not making that up. And first of all, how did you feed yourself for 10 years based on the China auto market? When did GM get there? My first visit, I can remember going to the Forbidden City, leaving my driver, thinking, okay, I know what the car looks like. And then I walked out 2 hours later and it was 1,000 other cars that looked exactly like that car because it was all Volkswagen, whatever the model was that they were.
Santanas,
Yeah.
yes.
Volkswagen, I think, was the big player early.
They were the people's car of China. They had 60, 70% market share. And then Beijing Jeep was in there. Peugeot was in there with a joint venture making a 505. But essentially, the Germans with the Santana, and then later they added the Jetta, small sedan. They totally dominated the Chinese market through the 90s. So if we go back in time, Joe, my very first trip to China as a graduate student, I met at the airport, and the driver there, white gloves and the cap and everything else, and zero English, of course, very polite, very friendly. He points me toward this car. It was colored this kind of powder blue, and I'm looking for a brand. I don't see one. It was the Shanghai sedan. Oh, what? There's a brand called Shanghai. They made a few thousand of them a year for officials and maybe universities and research institutes. Three on the tree, manual transmission, big bench seats. And I said, oh, this is based on a Russian car that was based on a German car from the 1940s. That's where China was in terms of its ability to make cars in 1986. At the end of that same year, I was at a university. We had a day off, a day of celebration, because the university was taking delivery of just what you mentioned, an actual Volkswagen Santana. It was moving into the modern age. Here we go, a German car built in China. This is so exciting. Everybody had the day off. Cars are driven down the center of the university. And I remember standing next to the president, and I said, whose car is that? Oh, knowing probably that it belongs to him or he gets use of it. But he said, oh, it belongs to the state.
Course.
Okay, right. So that was how few cars were in the country at that time and how far behind China had. They had ambitions. Deng Xiaoping famously went to Japan and the United States and said, those two countries are rich. They have auto industries. We should have our own. So he told his guys, go make it happen. But they looked around and they said, we have no capital, no experience, no human resources, no designers, no engineers. How do we get there? And just as you said, they began by forming joint ventures, initially with Volkswagen, and then gradually with virtually every other automaker in the world made their way in.
I first did business with BYD when they were just a battery company. And that was, I started in 2000. And then when I moved to China.
What did that look like? 2000 with BYD, what was happening?
Well, it was like a 10 watt bulb over the desk. If you didn't drink the tea really fast, it was going to be on the table. That's the story I always tell. Every place, the China five-star hotels always had like 10 watt light bulbs, and it was very dark, and they poured me tea and I wasn't drinking. And all of a sudden I noticed it was leaking out of the bottom, and so I downed it. But I was back on a regular basis. And it went from basically a total flim-flam to, you could see they were very serious in how they were going to execute versus, because Sony was the big competition then, because it was lithium-ion batteries, and they were making other batteries by hand. Yeah. They were busting girls in from the hinterland. And, you know, the first time I was there, I ate at the plant. Cafeteria was like rice coming out of plastic 55-gallon drums. And my whole take was, how can you compete with the Japanese? And they said, well, right now we make a lot of bad batteries, but we have testing equipment, so we know what world class is and what we can sell in the local market. This is the interesting thing. They were trying to please Nokia and Motorola, two names you don't hear a whole lot about anymore. But by 2005, when I moved there, I can remember the first day, and I lived in Minhang. I had to drive past where the Hongqiao hub is now. And back then it was just housing. But there was a BYD dealership there. And the old BYD logo was kind of a ripoff of BMW. And they made
it
like...
It definitely was, Joe. And you reminded me just now, right, those old days, they had a BMW-type logo and they moved past that. But...
And for the listeners, if you want to verify that, go out into Google Images and it'll show you the current BYD logo and the ripoff of...
Hey, wait a minute. But they both start with B. Come on.
Yeah. But at that time, because by then BYD had about 50,000 employees for the battery business, when they bought the car company, I thought, he's going to bankrupt himself. You know, there's just no way. This doesn't make any sense. Shows you how wrong you can be about something.
I remember, you're right, that his own board objected and said, we know nothing about this business, highly capital intensive. What advantages do we enjoy? This is not the good direction. And he said, thank you for your opinions. Full steam ahead.
Okay, so that was 19 years ago. And the narrative that I really hate about BYD, and I told a reporter this the other day, I'm sick of hearing about Warren Buffett backed BYD, because they were going to succeed. And it wasn't really Warren Buffett that wanted to invest. It was Charlie Munger. And that's a whole other story.
And not in cars, Joe. Remember, it was in energy storage. Like, cars at that time for BYD were still hit and miss, very shaky. So my
They didn't have an EV. Yeah. They were making ICEs. And I don't remember what state-owned company they bought.
Chuan up in Xi'an. Yeah, for a song. They bought it for nothing. Bankrupt.
So take me through your perspective on the rise of BYD and why Elon was blind to it. A couple of years ago, he was saying, you ever looked at their cars? Ha, ha, ha. How big a threat are they? And we'll get into today's news in a little bit, but how did that happen?
Joe, this one is tough because it really, I think, reveals the reality of how China evolves and Chinese industries and Chinese companies. Because while that vision may have been crystal clear for Wang Chuanfu, they had many setbacks along the way. As you mentioned, they started building these ICE-powered vehicles using Mitsubishi engines. The reputation for their cars, a fit and finish, reliability, the dealer experience, the service were last place in China. So people were very concerned, why are you in the car business? And then through the 2010s, with support of the Shenzhen government, they're able to sell some taxi fleets to, okay, you go to Shenzhen, you're going to ride in a BYD electric taxi. But still, through the 2010s, it wasn't entirely clear that BYD would emerge so triumphant as they have today. In fact, Joe, I'll take it a step further. I remember in 2018 and 2019, BYD had very thin profits, declining sales. And I thought, if you asked me in 2018, I would have said, well, it's a contender, but not a powerhouse. And suddenly they went into COVID and came out of COVID like Superman goes into the phone booth and comes out the other side, utterly transformed. Great looking cars, thanks to a staff of 600 designers led by the very best from Europe. So one thing, they vastly improved their designs. Secondly, they had a breakthrough with the Blade battery. And third, demand for electric cars inside China really began to take off. So those three things converged during COVID. We couldn't see it happening. And then they came out the other side. And I remember visiting BYD in 2022, meeting old friends there who I'd known for years. And they said, we know that you knew BYD from the beginning. We are no longer that company. We're a different company today. Wait until you see what we got coming. So I'd love Joe to say, oh yeah, it was clear and straight and rocket shot and that everything was automatic for BYD for that period of time. But the reality was China always surprises a little bit, and it didn't look like the kind of company that we see today.
Zalandez offers technology and services that support both direct lithium extraction and conventional evaporation ponds. Minimize the environmental impact of your lithium site through Zalandez data-driven insights and tailored solutions for each extraction method. Go to Zalandez.com for more information. That's Zalandez.com.
Give me a little granularity on the EV production landscape. We always hear about BYD, but there's several other, Li Auto, Xiaomi, whoever.
Yes.
How many EV makers are there, and how will that change as once the industry matures? I think the government will want to cull the number of suppliers.
Yes, the government, central government, definitely has that as an objective. We'll see if they're successful in doing so. But how to think about the EV industry? Think of BYD as the top dog, about almost 40% of the market inside China. Built 3 million cars last year, aiming to get to close to 3.6, 3.7 this year, including exports. So BYD is in its own class in terms of volume and product offerings. And then you have number two in China is Tesla. And then it's followed by a series of much smaller players, names like Li Auto, GAC Aion, NIO, XPeng, Leap Motor. Most of these companies were formed within the last 5 to 7 years by billionaires who had made their money in the technology sector and fashioned themselves or think of themselves as, well, we could be the Elons of China. And they're very impressive people, but young and sort of vulnerable companies. So one of the things is not all Chinese automakers are the same, right, Joe? You got BYD, been at it for 15, 20 years now, and these other guys are pretty new still. So you mentioned Xiaomi, Huawei's in the game now. That's all within the last 2 years. And in a sense, I feel like we're in the early days of the chapter two of China's auto industry. We're just getting started.
Where is Geely in all this?
Ah, Geely's in there too. With several brands, right? That's their signature. They own Volvo, Polestar, Zeekr, Lotus, Proton. There's many others that I...
That's the genesis of my question. Geely was a legacy, if China had legacy.
Yes.
And yeah, now their tentacles are all over. Do you see them as a big influencer, or is it just all... Everybody's now watching BYD and...
I'm glad you mentioned Geely. So, because they're a force, they're a formidable player. I didn't mention they also have a partnership with Mercedes to do the smart car. Li Shufu personally owns big chunks of Mercedes-Benz. So they're a global force. The thing that they've struggled with a little bit is, just to take an example, Volvo, Polestar, and Zeekr, three different brands that overlap a lot. So there's some cannibalism. And if you talk to people inside of the company, it's like, okay, we have three when maybe we should have one. So some of those might fall out, but Geely deserves recognition as sort of the first company to think globally in China with the acquisition of the Volvo brand way back in 2010. They completely turned that company around. It's making better profits and better products than it ever has. So you're right to point out Geely's a force in the industry. In recent couple of years, there's some worry that there's too many brands and they're spread too thin. And how is this going to work out?
Well, to harken back to one of your other comments that back in the day, everybody wanted to buy a foreign car. It proved that you had the money to do it because you had to pay the 100% luxury tax on it too. Mm-hmm. And I can remember the guy who had built the compound I lived in. He had a Porsche Cayenne, he had a Rolls Royce, he had a bunch of different vehicles that all proved that, you know, he could show his wealth on the road.
Show his wealth. Much more important than the driving pleasure. It's here, I've arrived. Mm-hmm. A woman in my office bought a Buick way back when, early 2000s. I said, why the Buick? She said, well, because I want to show up in front of the hotel, you know, on Friday night with my husband and have everybody look at me. Okay, there we go.
I have to mention another name. It's not a car company, but CATL is the biggest battery player in the world. BYD's a close second. How important has CATL been to the rise of electric vehicles in China? And when BYD came out with the Blade, CATL would sell the pack. Elon adopted LFP. It allowed him to be price competitive and start driving down the prices. How do you put CATL into the perspective of the rise of the China EV maker?
Absolutely foundational, because company, for example, we talked about Xiaomi, the world's number two smartphone maker, just launched their own product, the SU7, phenomenally good looking vehicle, a lot like the Porsche Taycan. Where do they get their batteries? CATL. Huawei, same story. So you have this sort of powerful force with CATL and BYD able to supply Chinese automakers and increasingly global automakers too. And without that, those battery makers and the supply chains that they've built up over the last decade, China's nowhere near as competitive as they are today. So two factors. One, it's driven costs down to have them at home. And then secondly, it's allowed the flowering of all these new startups like Xiaomi and Huawei overnight.
How do you see the geopolitics?
Oh,
we'll bounce around here now. Uh-huh. Well, our current administration and their plan to go all in on EVs, and the fact that the lithium ion battery was invented in the United States, the LFP was invented in the United States, the first lithium that went to the lithium ion battery was mined and processed in the United States. But right now, aside from Tesla, we're not in the game as far as I view it. What's your perspective on that?
How is this going to play out? Well, I'm reminded of when I first got to China so many years ago, Joe. The Western automakers had all the technology and the Chinese had none of it. And the Chinese said, we want to learn how to build internal combustion engines. So we're going to put in place some policies that essentially more or less encourage or force you to localize, starting with form the joint venture. Yeah. Secondly, you have to have local content and features these many engine components. So today, 2024, it's remarkable to the extent to which the roles have been reversed and China's way ahead. So how do we play it in the West? I feel as though, as Elon mentioned several weeks ago, absent tariffs, Chinese auto industry, the EV makers and battery makers, could easily overwhelm Western industries and wipe out many of them without tariffs. That's my view. What would I do? I'd say, let's take China's playbook and say, hey, let's form joint ventures here in America. We'll own a majority share. You have minority, but you get access to our lucrative market. And over time, we hope to be able to learn how you make batteries, That would be my guess. Is that the direction of DC? I don't know. But I see you smiling like, hey,
Well,
I guess
it clearly is not the direction of
we're
DC right now with the IRA rules in place, and I don't think the IRA rules are going to hold up to it won't accomplish the objective, and somebody's going to realize that soon, I believe, but we'll see how
So
long it takes.
let's take this. Let me ask you, Joe. So, absent of tariffs, do you feel that Elon was exaggerating, or do you think that's accurate? Without tariffs, the Western auto industry, automakers are highly vulnerable. I think he said they'd get demolished.
Well, I think that's true. But I think before we started recording, we talked about the level of subsidy and government help that this industry in China has had to get where it is. And we all like to think of ourselves as free traders over here. But if we don't take some action, we will be out in the cold, in my opinion. But I kind of like what you said a couple of minutes ago that take their playbook. I think it's insane to say we're not going to let CATL have anything to do with our battery industry, because if you want ubiquitous EVs, if the Biden administration wanted to put up or shut up, they'd do what ironically Trump said a couple of weeks ago on CNBC is like, I'm not going to let BYD make these cars in Mexico and bring them in here. I'll slap a tariff on them, big tariff. But hey, they're welcome to build them here. I don't know if he said welcome, but he said I'd let them build them here, and I want the jobs.
I want the jobs, bring the capital, bring the know-how, and we have to trust American ingenuity to be able to absorb that and run with it and not sit back.
Can
So,
we culturally do that though? I mean, that was China's playbook. That's the way they
they
operate. But
were hungry, Joe, right? They
We've
were
always
hungry.
liked to think of ourselves as too good to be do something tawdry, like say you can only own X percent, and
Right. Oh gosh. So yeah, I think today, Joe, here's the issue. We're still, by and large, having spent so many years in Asia, when I come back to the United States, the word complacency keeps coming to my mind. Like, we're very comfortable here, and all things being equal, let's just not change anything. This is good. We're good here. So how do you introduce urgency, the sense that actually we could have our they could eat our lunch easily overnight when we don't see Chinese cars on American roads? Most of my colleagues in the industry go, what's the big deal? But that's naive, and it's wrong. So how to introduce a sense of urgency, like, actually we're getting our asses kicked already, we just don't know it yet.
Well, what percentage of the global auto market is the United States?
Global auto market. So if
Yeah,
we're 80 million,
just our market, I mean, 80 or 90 million cars made, and we make.
50, we're around 15, the production say 12, so 12 on 80. China's more than twice the size in terms of production and sales.
Yeah, and my real point here is, yeah, we can try to protect our market, but we're going to be surrounded really quickly because the Chinese make the $5,000 car, the $10,000 car, the $15,000 car. Whether Elon said it or didn't say it about not making the Model 2, it's going to be a huge challenge. He's already referred to it as two waves of growth. And if the Model 3's as down market as they can be until 2026 or 2027, you got 3 more years of Chinese going into Southeast Asia, going into Europe, going into South America. It's
Mexico, where they're
India.
the number one supplier to Mexico, China.
Yeah. So that's where I think people are missing the point is that China really doesn't need the United States market. They can keep growing for quite a while. They want it, but
They
we.
would, they do want it. The profits are here, Joe. That's also true. The profits, most like, they're not making any money at home. They'll make slivers of money in Southeast Asia and Latin America. But remember the old Mao Zedong strategy and his own civil war with Chiang Kai-shek? He said, we'll take the countryside and surround the cities. And essentially, America and Europe are the cities, and China's just pouring into the
Yeah.
countryside, be it Africa, Middle East, Latin America. Southeast Asia, as you said, we're getting surrounded. So it's time for action. Time for a Sputnik 2 moment. where we come to terms with the fact that we're no longer the world leader in size or innovation or next generation technology. Somebody else is. What are we going to do about it?
Do you think America's ego can handle that?
I don't know. It's a test.
I've left somebody out here, and that would be Toyota.
Hmm.
Who are they still the world's largest automaker?
They are.
But they've changed their strategy. I can remember being in Toyota City in 2002 when I was living in Japan, and it was all we're going to do hydrogen. This is 22 years ago, and then we're going to make the Prius lithium, and then we're not because we want to fully depreciate our nickel metal hydride capital. And then he's gone back and forth and back and forth, and now he's crowing because first quarter their hybrid sales were so good. But to me, that seems myopic and not playing the long game. What are your thoughts on globally and then within the U.S., how big a piece of the pie can hybrids take?
I never want to bet against Elon, and I'm highly reluctant to bet against Toyota either, because in all my lifetime, they tend to win out. So what's going on? You remember, Joe, when you were there in Asia, when we were there, there was a geopolitical dimension to this too, where the Japanese had staked their claim on hydrogen and the Chinese said electric. And by and large, the Japanese probably felt like, well, we have the rest of the world's back and only China wants to go electric. Well, today we know electric's triumphing and hydrogen's fallen way behind. So then Japan looks around and goes, well, if we join the electric race with China, aren't we playing to their strength? Why don't we slow this pace a little bit? Why don't we encourage consumers to look at other powertrains like plug-in hybrid electrics or hybrids? And on that, from that perspective, I totally understand and respect their point of view. It's easy to criticize them. They're so slow to go electric, but maybe they're a little bit wiser. What's the rush to go electric when it's not in our favor right now?
I'd like to give Mr. Toyota credit for having foresight, but he's changed his mind so many times. I'm not sure. We might not be in a blind squirrel moment.
Uh-huh.
But let's just deal with reality.
Let's talk America, North America, though,
Joe. Yeah, America wants a car they don't have to worry about charging, and a hybrid gives them that. And I can see Toyota having a huge run. I would buy a Lexus hybrid.
Yes.
I mean, I've driven Toyota products for a long time because I'm a Lexus guy now. I was a GL8 guy when I lived in Shanghai because you had to be if you were an expat.
That's right. GL8 was it. Hey, let's return to American exceptionalism. What does the average American want? They don't want to have the stress of range anxiety and is the charging station working, and PHEVs or hybrids, they get you there. It's not perfect. But until such time that range on a battery electric vehicle gets up to like 800 miles and the charging infrastructure is totally reliable and convenient and quick. If people ask me today, you know, plug-in hybrid or battery electric, unless you're just living in city, small commutes, if you're making any kind of long distance trips, which we as Americans do a lot, go PHEV, go hybrid. We're not there yet with battery electrics.
You heard it here first, folks. This is an exclusive from Dunn Insights. If you're an American, go hybrid.
PHEV. If you're American, well, then the lines start to get drawn along national security lines, right? Joe, we got Biden administration most recently saying these Chinese cars will be smart cars, connected, and your data will go back to, now to the extent to which that's true, I don't know yet because we don't have the cars on the roads, but I could see a division of the global markets, like China plus and then America.
Well, your data now, I'm driving an ICE Lexus and it gives me a driving score on every trip. And that's all going somewhere. And the car companies have been selling it. And they're finally just, you know, I think it was GM got their
coming clean
hands. Busted. They got busted. And I guess as a pragmatist, I think, why do I care if the data's out there in the U.S. on some server? Why is it worse if my driving data is in China? I mean, what difference does that make? That doesn't give them access to my bank account.
Yet.
Well, yeah. Okay. Fair enough. as long as I don't connect my iPhone with all my banking information.
Yes, right. So on a slightly more serious note, I have seen, you know, one of the things that happens when you live in a country that long, I did see China change its mood and its stance vis-a-vis foreigners. So it's a less friendly place.
I know. My wife was involved in the school, and the guy's kids were in my kids' classes that did 9 years in prison on the iron ore thing.
Whoa.
And now you've got the whole exit issue that China says that you have a no exit on your passport. You're kind of like Tom Hanks in the airport, except for you're in China, you know, you got all of China to wander around in, but you can't get out.
You can keep your passport, but you cannot exit the country.
Yeah.
Okay. Can I talk to someone at the consulate? No, we prefer you not, just have tea with us here for a little while longer. It's changed for sure, sadly. And it's a concern, definitely.
Well, I never had concerns when I lived there. I wasn't worried about it. I mean, we knew our house was bugged. Mm-hmm. People showed up to fix things when we hadn't called anybody. We just talked about it. They had an intel in Shanghai within the same compound. And those guys, I think, all used burners when they came in. But here we are. And it does seem a much more unfriendly towards foreigner world to me. And even like the social score. And
can I ask you a question? Let's go back to the situation here in the United States, auto industry. The Chinese would love to export their cars here and sell them here. We might get completely steamrolled by them, vulnerable because they have the scale, the cost, and the ambition to access the U.S. market. You're advising the next president, whoever it is. What's the way forward? Do we pull back on electrics? Do we accelerate our efforts to go electric? Or do we just sort of let it play out?
I always think you're better off with more competition rather than less. And you can talk about level playing fields all you want, but the Chinese already can make a car at price points that people want to buy. I would let a certain amount of them in, mm-hmm. hoping that you've got EV penetration across the spectrum, and hoping that some of the alliances, like you referred to earlier, letting them have JVs or however you bring them in. But I think our legacy automakers could not handle that model. Then how do you do it? Because Tesla's sure not going to do it, because that's not Elon's style.
No, it's not.
What's the solution?
This episode is also brought to you by Mississippi Lime, your innovation partner for solutions related to lime and calcium in your critical mineral processes. Visit lime4lithium.com. That's LIME, the number 4, LITHIUM.com.
I do think we'd be better off if a certain amount of BYDs were sold here, a certain amount were allowed.
I hadn't
allowed
thought of that. That's a good idea, Joe. So cap it. Say you guys can bring in these many. Are you happy? Here, come on in. But it's going to be capped.
And you put enough of a tariff on it so they can hit a price point, but mm-hmm. that capital is accruing to develop our industry, our battery market, our cathode market. That's
do you think Ford, GM, and Stellantis, or just let's talk Ford, GM, do you think they have the wherewithal to catch up? Do they have the eye of the tiger, or is that gone already? We need to look to a Rivian, Tesla, and others.
Let's look at what GM said.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was Q4 of 20 or 21. I don't remember which year. We're going to take Tesla down in North America by 2025. And now we all see that as a completely fatuous statement, because it wasn't but a couple months later that they were recalling 100% of their EVs for battery problems. I think they have the ambition. I think they get enough cash flow from their current ICE business where they can tolerate. Like, Rivian doesn't have anything to fall back on. You have two very different situations.
Yes.
But I don't believe that the old legacy big three all exist in 2030. I think maybe private equity owns the truck businesses, and maybe two survive. I don't think all three of them can survive.
Mm.
But you're an auto expert. I'm just a
Yeah.
guy that likes to talk about lithium.
Well, when I was at GM, even this is 10 years ago, even in Indonesia, we would talk about what is the DNA of General Motors today. This was 10 years ago, it's still true today. It's a North American truck company. Do it very well. Big SUVs, big trucks. And that's it. If you look around the world, and for people who live in the United States and don't get a chance to go overseas, market after market after market, GM and Ford are no longer competitive. They're not in, if they're in there, they're tiny. So Japan, let's go down Japan, Korea, Indonesia, Vietnam, India, Thailand, most African countries, Middle East, Europe. Where are they competitive outside of North America?
Well, the Yakuza do like Cadillacs with the left-hand
That's
drive.
true. That's true. Point taken. And the sheiks in the Middle East like their big rigs too, and they have no import duty. So the sort of two sweet spots are North America and parts of Japan
Niche
and then
markets, let's say.
niche markets. And when if you think about it with clear eyes, you say, my goodness, that's a business in trouble. You backed yourself into a corner. You do large trucks very well, but the rest of the industry, look at little Hyundai and Kia. How is it that a country the size of the state of Michigan can be doing such fabulous product designs, doing electrics?
In 1985, I went to Bob Moore Hyundai in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, and bought a Hyundai.
Oh,
Yes, I did.
BLS.
And I
Yeah.
had that thing for,
1985.
yeah, it was, well, I went to a Toyota dealership and they were so fat, dumb, and happy then. They said, you have to put a deposit in. You don't get to pick the color. You take what comes in, it'll be 3 months. And the Hyundai guy had a bunch. I bought the top of the line. I think I paid $5,700 for it, and that car
5,700.
lasted. I drove that car for 11 years, but
Wow.
I started going to Korea in '95, and I saw it was a little bit like Japan with the Crown and some of the other high-end executive luxury cars that they didn't export back then. And it was astounding to me the first time I was in Seoul in 95. I said, why don't they sell these cars in America?
Yeah.
They were making great, and they took their time, and I see more Kias now around me. It's amazing how many Kias I see
Fabulous.
in our
Just
area.
phenomenal what they've done and continue to do. So the Detroit Three, I think they have to look at themselves in the mirror and say, why not us? What's different? Why can't we do that in?
Well, I see the U.S. auto industry, though, as being the Japanese here, the Germans here. I mean, I think we're a little bit myopic if we look at it, that they create jobs. I mean, BMW's been in Greer, South
That's a
Carolina
good point.
for
Yes.
how many years now? So I think if I'm advising the president, if forget the big three is the only sign of American auto life, let's
That's a
get
good point.
the guys who make the best batteries. I mean, Korea and Japan still make, what was Tesla based on? The
Panasonic.
18650 Panasonic cells.
Yes, that's true. So it's almost as if, ironically, at home, the Detroit two or two and a half or three, whatever you want to call them, are the marsupials on the savannah. They're the least, they're the most vulnerable among all the automakers. And meanwhile, these transplants from Germany and Korea and Japan doing quite well, still competitive, very competitive here on in North America.
Well, let's take a step back and just look at global again. Where do you see EV penetration globally between now and the end of the decade?
Okay. So if we say round numbers, last year call the market 80 million and we're at about 14 on 80, give or take, depending on how you classify things. But I can see that going to, by 2030, I could see it being a third, which would be, I don't know, what's a third, 20, between 25 and 30 million, mostly in China, followed by Europe. And then gradually the United States. I think the United States is going to be a different market for many years to come, because what do we like to do, Joe? We like to drive big rigs at high speeds, trail something behind us, hills we don't want to worry about. That's the opposite of what a battery powered vehicle likes to do. So I see a much more gradual movement toward EVs in the United States. Where it's surprising is to see penetration by BYD and others in markets like Thailand, and this year in Brazil. BYD, shocker, will sell more than 100,000 cars in Brazil this year.
That isn't really a shocker to me, though.
Without the infrastructure and all everything else, you think? Like,
yeah, I think in some cases, and I think this may happen in Chile as well, countries that have lithium. The Chinese go in, they say, look, we're going to make batteries here, because that's always what countries want, is more economic development than just a mine or whatever. And I think that's part of it. BYD's courted Brazil now for the last 3 or 4 years, and it's not all lithium, but part of it is we'll be more accepted if we promise some things. Making batteries.
And they're refurbishing that Ford plant. So they're going to manufacture locally. That's jobs, tax revenues. Ah, okay.
All right. Since you're an old China hand, and I think I saw the Art of War on your LinkedIn page. So if you're going to talk about the lessons of the Art of War, what should Europe and North America be internalizing as they try to compete with China?
Yes. So two of my favorite sort of subchapters from the Art of War. One is, keep in mind, deception is everything. Deception is everything. Let me repeat that one more time. Deception is everything. So when you sit down to negotiate with the Chinese or compete with them, one of the things, please keep in mind, and it's nothing personal, it's not even a value judgment, it's just that by design, what they say is probably not aligned with what they intend to do. Okay, yeah. So that's number one. Number two, when they negotiate with you and they say win-win, you know where this is going, Joe. The reality is they say that means I, China, win twice. Win-win.
Yeah.
And then in Chinese language, it gets even tougher. They say, Ni si wo huo, you die, I live.
Yeah.
All right. That's pretty clear where we're coming from. So don't underestimate the tenacity, the ambition of the Chinese when it comes to competition. That'd be number one. And number two, Sun Tzu is famous for this line, said, of the 36 strategies in his arsenal, the best strategy overall is to be invisible, or to, in the Chinese, it says Zou Wei Shang Zi, to remove yourself from the arena is the most powerful. So you have to think, what? That's counter to everything. We love smash mouth football, go straight ahead and hit the other guy. When you're dealing with the Chinese, they'll often go dark, and it's very unsettling. Like, I didn't hear from that person. They didn't answer my call. I don't know what's going on. Yes, precisely. You're kind of guessing. So as we engage with the Chinese increasingly around the world, and they're coming to our neighborhoods, just be mindful that they're very, very good negotiators, and they're tenacious as hell. And they tend to think of Americans, most of my Chinese friends tell me, Americans are naive. So none of us like to think we're naive. I'm not naive. Joe, are you naive? No, you're not naive. But compared to the Chinese, when the Chinese look at that, they think, gosh, these guys are wet behind the ears.
Well, I'll make another observation. My driver, who's still a friend of mine, who didn't go to college, he knew more about American history
yes
than the average U.S. high school graduate, And I think the concept of know your enemy or know your competitor is deeply ingrained in the Chinese. And our guys go over there and, oh, they don't speak English.
Right. How come they're not speaking English yet? I'm sure they're going to get there one day, but I don't understand. No, you remind me actually. Yeah, that's the line. It's like, know yourself, know your enemy. You'll never have any worries in any engagement. You'll always win. But you're right. The driver, your driver, you say Kansas, he says Topeka.
And well, he knew all the way we taught him geography that he didn't know was he was a big NBA fan. Here's a map now. Put the teams on there.
So what's going on there? Why are Americans, are we just generally incurious, or is it that America offers a lot to be interested, like the NBA, whereas China is not, you know, it doesn't have the soft power that Korea has today? It's sort of like, oh, China, I don't know what I'm going to get excited about. Well, there.
Think back to when you took world history. You didn't learn about world history.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that Singapore fell the day after Pearl Harbor until I went to the Changi War Museum with my daughters when we were living in Asia. Yeah. I went to the Killing Field. Our world history is America's influence in Europe mostly.
Yes.
And you know, a little bit in Asia and maybe a little bit in South
That's
America.
So true.
Yeah. Last question. VinFast is coming to my home state of North Carolina. What do you think of them? What do you think of Vietnam's chances in the EV game?
VinFast is a formidable company. Of course, it belongs to this Vin Group, the largest corporation in Vietnam, led by the wealthiest man in Vietnam, Chairman Vuong. I've had the opportunity, the honor to meet with him a few times and his team, his leadership team. My takeaway on VinFast, very young company, learning very quickly, and it will take them time to evolve. But a couple data points. One is I recently had the chance to test drive their newest vehicles with dealers from the United States. And those dealers know cars. They've been in the business 30, 40 years. And I said, how does this stack up? And they said, we think the current VinFast is a Hyundai in about 2019, 2020. Whoa.
I would have said 2012 or 2013.
Okay. And then it's just one dealers, you know, a couple got dealers, but they've been in the business a long time. And they didn't say it in front of VinFast people, but they said, that's where they are and they're going to get better. So today, in fairness, we've read the reviews. They're not good, but that was their first product, imagine. And if I compare VinFast's first product with BYD's first product or Geely's first product, definitely much further ahead than they were. So that's one. Second one, just briefly, I feel like it's a Korean situation, a Chaebol, where VinFast will be the national champion, enjoys the full backing of the Hanoi leadership. It's going to get there. It won't be straight line, but I think they'll eventually be a competitive force globally.
Where are they getting their batteries?
Currently, they get their batteries from China, from CATL, Goshen.
The usual suspects.
Yeah. Well, even though you ask them, who do you like doing business with the most? The West. Do you like doing business with the Chinese? No. Where do you get your batteries from? China. I feel like, give you a direct answer about VinFast, they have made significant improvements on their products in the last 24 months, and I'm optimistic they're going to find their way. Yeah. Yeah.
What did I miss? No, what should I ask you that I didn't?
No, it's beautiful. Rapid conversation.
Fire. Rapid fire. Favorite word in any language?
Sabaidi. That's Thai for just in the zone, comfortable, relaxed.
Last book you read?
Last book I read would be Chip Wars.
If you couldn't live in the U.S., where would you live?
Only one choice.
You're a rich guy. You can have multiple homes. I'm not going to limit you.
Oh, gosh. First one that comes to mind is Thailand.
But where? Probably
up in Chiang Mai in the north. Second one would be Tuscany, Siena.
Yeah.
Okay. San Gimignano.
Hard to park.
Yeah. And then the third, a close third would be Kobe.
Yeah, I lived in Kobe, so
Did you?
yeah, 5.5 years.
What do you think? So I was only there to
Yeah,
visit short time.
it's a great place to live. I belong to the oldest golf course in Japan. It was up the hill, up Rokusan. I'd move back to Kobe.
Awesome, awesome country. What was I going to say? For some reason, I'm spacing the name. What's the most famous destination, historical destination in Japan? Not
Well, Kyoto or
Kyoto.
Nara.
Kyoto. Kyoto. So I went to Kyoto with fr Japanese friends, and they said, "Hey, inside secret, check out Kobe." So I was like, "Okay." And then I went to Kobe. I was like, "Ooh, this is beautiful."
And the best piece of advice you were ever given.
Best piece of advice ever given.
I have never asked this question in 183 episodes, but
Yeah,
you just seem like the guy who would answer that.
from my dad, get out and make things happen. Yeah,
Okay.
get out. He
It's a
didn't
good
mean get
one.
out of the house,
Yeah.
like get out. Go out. When I harken back to the day, I think I told you already in this conversation, finished school, had the conversation with him. What now? Work for an automaker and make $100,000 out of Michigan, or go to Asia and try to make something happen? He goes, "It's obvious what the answer is. You go to Asia." Okay, but what am I going to do when I get there? You'll figure it out.
It seems like you did.
Yeah, thank
Michael, thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Joe, always very enjoyable the conversation with you. Thank you.
Great to have Michael on. He knows his stuff. I truly respect his tenure in China and the relationships he built. I only became familiar with Michael in the last year or so. I got an invitation to be on his podcast, which is called Driving with Dunn, and you might want to check that out. Even after 184 episodes, I still learn a lot from just about every podcast I do. Even though I know some of the guests very, very well, this kind of conversation always pulls out some new nugget. And with Michael, I think I learned quite a bit just in the 90 minutes we talked, the preamble before we started recording. And we got so deep in conversation that I wish I had gotten some of that on this podcast. But I finally said, hey, we should just start recording. In any case, I won't leave you with a proverb this time, but I will tell you that if you haven't read The Art of War or a book called 36 Strategies of the Chinese, you might want to do that. They are very instructive as to how the Chinese think, and in many cases, it's quite different than the way Westerners think. Thanks again for listening.